you're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Traveling to work requires time and money, but workers who punch the clock at home might actually miss that commute that separates work time from home life. There's that bit of me time in between that is lost. We get tips to recreate that transition in and out of work time. Angela Haupt is managing editor of health at U.S. News. She also was a contributing writer for The Washington Post. She wrote an article called Why a Fake Commute Could Pave the Way to Work-from-Home Balance. She talked with WPR host Keely Baltina in March.
One of the reasons people say they want to work from home is that they save so much time not on a commute. Why are people actually longing for that?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? I remember I even was really thrilled to lose my commute. What a time suck it was and how much lost time there was. But now, a year in for many of us, we realize that that commute time actually served a really valuable purpose. It was buffer time. You know, it was a chance for us to decompress, you know, to shake off all the stress from the day when we were headed home, or, you know, in the morning when we were heading into work, to kind of transition from our home role into our work role. So what we're seeing now is that all of our roles, you know, home, work, it's all just blurring together. And we no longer have that built-in space every day to kind of, again, shake the day off and just decompress from all of that stress.
And on average, the amount of time that at-home workers are spending on work has changed. Are people working longer now?
They certainly are. So what's interesting is that back before the pandemic, the average commute time was 38 minutes each way. So now, for starters, we've lost that commute time. So we no longer have that time to ourselves built into every day. And we've taken on more work. So researchers are saying that we are mostly working about 48 extra minutes every day, so almost an hour. And that includes more meetings every day and more communication that spills into the off hours. So, you know, those emails and Slack messages that are coming through at 8, 9, 10 p.m. that, you know, we should be responding to. And yet so many of us do find ourselves responding to in our off hours.
Yeah. So if we're working more, it makes sense then that people are looking for a brighter line to draw between work and home life. Some people you talk to about creating a fake commute, they really do get in their car or hop on a bike, leave home and then come back. How does that help?
So basically, a fake commute, as those who advocate for it are calling it, is really any ritual that helps you, you know, create a buffer in your day. So some people will hop into their car and they'll drive out for coffee. Or else, if they don't really have anywhere to go, they just kind of drive around the block and they put on some music or they put on a podcast. You know, other people are going out for bike rides or they're doing yoga or stretching in the backyard. And what it is it's just this, you know, this separation between the different roles we play. So in the morning, it's a separation period from being a mom or, you know, being a person at home. And it kind of helps us get set up and have that, you know, that buffer time, that space to think about, okay, here I am, I'm getting ready to transition into being a supervisor, you know, being a person clicking away on a computer all day. And then at the end of the day, if you can repeat this activity, then, you know, whatever ritual it is that you've decided makes sense for you, you know, again, that gives you the chance to decompress, you know, to really start thinking about, you know, what's coming up in your next role. For example, one of the researchers I spoke to called this role clarifying prospection. So you finish the workday, you go on your fake commute, you can kind of think about, okay, here's what I want to watch on TV this evening, or here's what I might make for dinner this evening. But you can really start thinking in your head about what's coming up for you at home and really transitioning into that role. So then when you do transition back into, you know, being a person at home, you can really be present and not just be stressing or dwelling about everything that happened during the workday.
And you're saying, even now, you don't necessarily have to leave your house. You could do yoga in the backyard, you mentioned, or there are others you talk to who just tidy up or intentionally step away from devices, right?
Yes, absolutely. So one woman I spoke to actually said, you know, she realized she really missed listening to her podcast because she used to listen to them on her drive into work, her drive out. And all of a sudden she felt like, you know, she didn't really know what was going on anymore. And she missed that time that she just really enjoyed. So what she started is that every morning now she wakes up and she has this little playlist of podcasts and she starts listening all through, you know, the time she spends getting set up for the day. And she actually spends about 90 minutes listening at the beginning of her day before she logs on to work. I spoke to some other people who just, you know, they go out into their backyard. Some of them bring their kids along. And, you know, one woman pointed out, kids are missing out on commute time too. You know, whether that was riding the school bus into school or that time where mom or dad was driving them in and they could kind of chat before getting dropped off. So it really can be, you know, you don't have to leave your home. It could be as simple as going into your backyard and stretching, you know, listening to some music, just going for a walk around the block. It's really any ritual that you feel like you can stick to, because one of the keys is that you should do it as many days of the work week as possible. And ideally, it lasts at least 5 to 10 minutes.
Angela Haupt is a writer and editor. She recently wrote about creating a fake commute so people who work from home can separate work time and personal time. You're listening to this conversation on the Ideas Network. Angela, talk more about the importance of consistency in that sort of commuting before and after working from home.
You know, it takes some work to make this work for you. And what I've heard from some people is that they get really serious about scheduling it into their day. And so they'll go online to, you know, their Outlook calendar, their Google calendar, and they'll actually block out that, you know, just 30 minutes, 20 minutes at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. And that way, nobody can send them meeting invites for that time. You know, their calendar shows that they're unavailable. But really, sometimes that's what it takes is, you know, scheduling it into your day to make sure that you're actually going to give yourself that time. And then I also spoke to some experts who mentioned it's really important to do what you can to, you know, silence your Slack notifications or uninstall your work email from your phone after hours. I mean, some of these things may seem like, maybe it seems a little dramatic, but we really are. We've become, you know, workers who are online all the time. And so it's up to us to kind of reclaim our time and to take those actions that can help, you know, prevent us from being so, you know, on all the time.
So there's the scheduling aspect of it. And then how can we communicate that to colleagues so it's effective, but also so someone's coworkers take it seriously?
Yes. You know what? It comes down to just being really frank about what you're doing and to take no shame in saying, hey, I have this time carved out to clear my head. You know, I have me time at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. And what I have found and what the folks I talked to found is that, you know, just be as transparent as possible. And often you'll find your coworkers will respect that because probably even if it's not something that they've already implemented into their own work days, they can recognize and appreciate that need, you know. And I spoke to a really busy doctor out in California, and he actually did that with his coworkers. He was frank about carving out that time for himself, and they decided to join him. So now he meets some of them outside for a socially distant bike ride on a trail. And then he said, you know, then they all go back home to their separate computers, you know, which are miles apart, and they meet each other online for a, you know, their first thing in the morning virtual meeting. I thought that was a really interesting point that you might even, depending on your circumstances and where you live, you might even be able to include your coworkers or at least encourage them to try the same thing themselves.
Some people are used to driving or biking by themselves. Other people used to hop on a bus. Do you have to create the same commute for it to be effective these days?
No, absolutely not. Things have changed for all of us. That includes the commute. So it doesn't need to be the same as what you used to do. I think this is a great time to try something new and, you know, see what works for you. The most important thing is just as long as it's time in which you can clear your head, you know, shake off the day and give yourself that space, that transition time, that's going to be great. And so the exact thing that you do, that's completely up to whatever you think you'll enjoy and stick to the most.
Angela, do you have a fake commute?
You know, I do. I have two dogs. And so what I realize is that I can take them both for a walk at the beginning of the day and then at the end of the day. And they absolutely love that. That's great for them. You know, they like the routine and knowing what's coming. They get really excited at the end of the day, start looking at the leashes. And I found it's really, really good for me because I can clear my head and decompress. And then the people around me really seem to appreciate it when it lifts my mood for the rest of the day.
Angela, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was writer and editor Angela Haupt talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. They discussed how some workers can create a sort of commute to improve balance when work happens at home. You can read the piece in the Washington Post. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we explore the impact of remote work for employees who are on the autism spectrum. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we talk about work from home on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Remote office work has challenged people who thrive being surrounded by their colleagues and who can easily navigate the coffee machine banter. Yet the switch to working in different places with fewer people could offer employees on the autism spectrum more opportunities. Alexandra Samuel is an author and technology researcher. Her piece in the Wall Street Journal explored how, as remote work becomes more common in the job market, it opens up vast new possibilities for people who have autism. She co-authored the book Remote Inc., and she talked with WPR host Keely Boltina in March.
Your forthcoming book is focused on remote work, but you don't lead with that in what you've written. You start your piece by explaining you've worried about your autistic son and work. What do you want people to know?
Well, I think we have this idea that everybody kind of comes into the modern workplace as a same-sized widget, you know, and we can all just drop into our desks and our cubicles and start working away. And what I've become really aware of over the years with my son, you know, really it's been a kind of a 15-year journey now, is that the differences that we've learned to work with and accommodate in the classroom, of course, follow kids right through into adulthood. And when we expect everybody to be, as we call it, neurotypical, we miss a lot of the differences that give people additional contributions they can make in the workplace, but also sometimes challenges. And what's exciting for me about remote work is that precisely because it takes people out of the workplace, it creates room for each of us to be our own kind of special snowflake. And if you're autistic, that means you can work in a way that works for you as an autistic person. But that is also true. We all have our little edges and quirks. And when you're at home, you can work in a way that builds to those strengths.
What made you realize that the flip from in-person office to remote work could really increase the odds of people like your son having success?
Well, I will confess, I mean, our lives changed a lot less during COVID than most people's, because my son was already being homeschooled and my husband and I had both transitioned to working from home in order to be available to support his homeschooling. So when COVID hit and we all had to lock down, my son said one day, "Ah, finally, this is a vindication of my lifestyle." And there's some truth in that. And I've heard that from a lot of autistic people on Twitter, right? Like, for so many years, if you're not the kind of person who wants to leave the house every day, if you're not the kind of person who really thrives in a crowded office, you've been the odd man out. And now that everybody has to be in their little bubble and their little cocoon of solitude at home, if that is actually your happy place and you really thrive when you're solo, that creates real opportunities for people who are neurodivergent, who don't have the same wiring that we think of as, you know, quote unquote, mainstream.
Talk more about what you just touched on, this idea of a traditional office environment challenging some people on the autism spectrum.
Well, you know, one of the people I interviewed for this story is a guy who's a business analyst in the tech industry named Hunter Hansen, who also has a video blog about working as an autistic person and living as an autistic person. And one of the things he said to me in our interview that actually was just super helpful for me as well in thinking about my son is, you know, as an autistic person, there's no such thing as a good surprise. And when you're outside your home, you know, whether it's at the office, at the store, at a concert, life is surprising. Things happen that you did not expect. And for some people, there's more resilience for that. And for other people, a surprise can be really discombobulating. And when you take all of that away, it just creates so much more room for people to focus on their work instead of focusing on managing all that sensory stimulus.
And we should be clear, this goes across the org chart. I mean, we're talking entry-level workers, but also middle managers, department leaders who are autistic and can experience these barriers at work too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we have to be cautious. I mean, it's become a little bit trendy in recent years as autism has become more understood and more accepted. I think a lot of us have started to like look again at people who would never have identified as being autistic. And there's a lot of kind of armchair diagnoses going on. But certainly there are lots of people in the workplace now who may never have been diagnosed or may never have thought of themselves as autistic, but who still
benefit from having a different kind of sensory environment. And those folks are all the way up to the C-suite. I mean, there are people in every level, in every organization who have different kinds of quirks. Sometimes they disclose them. Sometimes they know them and they can say, I'm autistic. Here's what I need to succeed. Sometimes they may not even know that they have differences that might affect their productivity and that might enable them to make a stronger contribution if they had a quiet space.
Alex Samuel researches and writes about technology. She's got a book coming out about remote work called Remote Inc. And we're talking about how working remotely creates more possibilities for autistic people. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Alex, one example you note is that we don't have doorway conversations when people work remotely. Those are on messaging platforms. How does that benefit people on the spectrum?
Well, I mean, one thing I haven't said that I really need to say is that there is no one-size-fits-all answer for autistic people any more than there is for neurotypical people. And in the autism community, people love to say, you know, when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. So there are people who really thrive on the social interaction of the in-office. And one of the concerns about this shift to remote work is that for people on the spectrum who may not have a lot of social interaction outside of work, this can be a very isolating time, just like it is for a lot of neurotypical people. That said, there are other folks who find that the most challenging part of the office is like all the body language stuff that happens in meetings. And so when you get rid of the hallway conversations where you can be taken by surprise, or you get rid of the boardroom conversations where so much of what's being said is not being said verbally, it's being said through gestures, through glances, through eye contact, then it levels the playing field. And if you're not someone who is really great at reading body language, then working remotely over text can be really liberating, because what you see is what you get. Hopefully people are a little more straight up and direct, which can also be really helpful. And also you can deal with incoming messages at your own pace. So if you need a little time to yourself before you're ready to plunge in, then, you know, texting and asynchronous communication is really beneficial. But, you know, that's true for a lot of neurotypical people as well. Getting away from having to work on somebody else's schedule and starting to follow your own natural energy cycles is exactly why we are all generally more productive when we're working remotely, once we mastered the skill of working remotely. And that's, you know, that's really what we were writing about in the book is, you know, what are the skills you need in order to become more productive when you're remote? Because whether you're autistic or neurotypical, you're actually going to have to figure that out.
Yeah, it's certainly a different environment. What do you think about this idea, though, that remote work could prevent us from really seeing one another and acknowledging and adapting to differences?
That, I think, is really one of the biggest worries about remote work. And one of the people I interviewed for my journal piece is this fabulous woman, Joy Johnson, who is autistic herself and works with families who have autistic kids. She's a behavior analyst and she's in the middle of doing her PhD. She pointed out to me, I mean, I'm all bullish about remote work, rah, rah, because I love doing everything online. I'm a tech nerd. But she reminded me that, you know, it's taken a really long time to bring many organizations around to the idea of making accommodations for people who are autistic or have other kinds of differences. Her concern, and I think it's a realistic one, is that now that remote work has proven itself viable for so many roles, companies may no longer make the effort to make the workplace more inclusive. And instead, the go-to will be, oh, you know, you have mobility issues, you have attention issues, you have sensory issues. Well, you can just work from home. And then that shunts diversity out of the workplace. It really impoverishes what we can do as a team because we are no longer hearing a breadth of voices. And it also means that, you know, for people in the disability world or the autism world, that their choices are suddenly constricted. And that really is the worst case outcome here.
What about the flip side? If a company expects people to come back into an office after having employees work remotely, do you think remote work could be considered a reasonable accommodation now?
For so many years, organizations have put people on the defensive when they ask for remote work as an option and say, you know, well, what makes you think this job can be done remotely? Well, now we've seen that just about every job, at least like every white collar job, professional job, can be done remotely. And, you know, a lot of people in the disability community have commented, like, all these years we were asking for this accommodation and we were told it wasn't possible, but the second able-bodied people want to work from home, suddenly it's possible. So I do hope that this shifts the balance or the burden of proof so that it's no longer an unreasonable request if you ask to work from home. But, you know, like anything, at the end of the day, what this is really about is what helps a team work effectively, what helps each individual work effectively, and there is no one answer to that.
Alex, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
And that was author and technology researcher Alexandra Samuel talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. Find a link to Alexandra's article at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, how much have you paid attention to CDC guidance in the pandemic? We look at how government agencies can improve the guidance they issue. Have you felt confused by federal guidance documents? Do you know where to even find them? A line for you, 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the role of guidance documents issued by federal agencies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, issued a guidance document in late May titled Emergency Use Authorization for Vaccines to Prevent COVID-19. Clearly, very important guidance. One of the first sentences on the 25-page guidance to industry: the FDA is committed to providing timely guidance to support response efforts to this pandemic. Do you adhere to guidance documents in your industry? Were you ever confused by guidance issued by the CDC or other agencies? Do you know where to find these documents? Have you provided public comment? 800-642-1234. Susan Webb-Yaki is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and a professor of public affairs and political science. Her new report is called Guidance on Regulatory Guidance, What the Government Needs to Know and Do to Engage the Public. Susan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. I'm so delighted to be here.
Well, give us a working definition of guidance documents. How do you describe them?
Yeah, so guidance documents are policy tools that are used by federal agencies as well as state agencies, and they're really used to make policy statements on behalf of those government entities. They, in particular, are used to clarify the meaning of existing statutes or existing regulations, but really they provide the state-of-the-art thinking of that agency's on any particular policy topic.
Yeah, I mean, in your report, you call these documents forward-looking policy instruments. Can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you think about a congressionally passed statute or a government rule and regulation that passed through the notice and comment process, which is a very kind of technical and legalistic process to make legally binding rules, those statutes and those rules are instruments. They're ways in which governments make policy decisions. And agency guidance documents are policy instruments too. They're just a different means of making those decisions. And one of the reasons they're so attractive to government agencies is that they can be issued, at least at present, really quickly. And they create a great level of responsiveness of those government agencies to changing circumstances. They also have some negative and downsides as well, but the real positives are that they're timely and flexible tools.
Yeah, because certainly the policymaking process itself can sometimes be long and arduous, so these, you see them more as sometimes quick fixes, Band-Aids.
Well, that's one way to think about it. I mean, we need to have a plethora of tools in our toolkit for government actors. And certainly guidance documents are one tool that are quicker and more flexible. Think of presidential executive orders as another tool that's pretty quick and can be issued with really no process or no deliberation and compromise. Guidance documents are similar to that.
Well, speaking of executive orders, President Biden's time in office, right away he acted in January with this executive order. What is the president trying to do about guidance documents?
Yeah, so presidents from both sides of the political aisle, as well as members of Congress from both sides of the political aisle, have long seen some problems related to the guidance document process. Let me just list a couple of those problems. So I already mentioned some of the positives. They're flexible, they're timely responses that the government agencies can issue to try to clarify statutes and regulations for businesses or the public. But there's some downsides too. For instance, agencies define guidance document really differently. And so that makes it hard to understand what they are across different agencies. Mm-hmm. Another problem is there's no place that collects all guidance documents together and kind of brings them together in a uniform spot for citizens and businesses to understand kind of what the current thinking is on agencies. And a couple others is that there's no way for the public to uniformly comment on really important guidance documents. And so when President Biden got into office, he was looking back at some of the efforts of President Trump and kind of deciding where he wants to make his mark, like every president does. And one of the first things he did was rescind, revoke or take back, an executive order that President Trump issued on guidance documents. And that executive order that President Trump issued was really trying to raise the transparency and the level of public engagement and guidance. Now, I expect President Biden will very likely issue his own executive order or do something in the policy space on the guidance document process. It might be a little different than what President Trump did, but again, presidents of both parties recognize that there's a need to make this process more transparent and easier for the public to understand.
So if guidance is not meant to be binding, how are agencies able to enforce their guidance documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. You really hit the nail on the head. Guidance is guidance, right? It's supposed to guide public behavior. But the trick is that, and many commenters have suggested this across time, is that businesses and citizens often treat guidance as binding, right? Some scholars say it, quote, coerces compliance, end of quote, right? And the reason it does that is that, again, these guidance documents are the agency's current thinking, their best thinking on their kind of policymaking decisions. And agencies make a lot of important policy decisions for businesses and citizens. So they make enforcement decisions where they might assign penalties to businesses for not complying. So we see that in, for instance, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA space, where they might fine a company for pollutants, for instance. Or you see that in the permitting space, where before you can go forward with your construction project, you need to have the right permitting. Right. Mm-hmm. So agencies use these guidance documents to help make those decisions. Right. So if you are not in compliance with the guidance document, you might have an enforcement action against you, or you might not get that permit. So it really, they do really have teeth, even if they are only guidance.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Susan Webb Yockey, who's director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and she's a professor of public affairs, wrote a recent report on how to improve guidance documents. You can join in. Have you ever been confused by guidance issued recently in the CDC, in the pandemic, or other agencies? Have you had issues understanding federal or state guidance? Join in, 800-642-1234. Susan, I was reading a report just came out in Pharma Intelligence that said the FDA is struggling to regulate the supplements industry, in part because draft guidance on compliance with all these new dietary ingredients, the guidance, it's not coming out fast enough, and that the oversight lags behind the explosive growth of the supplement market. Of course, we don't have all the facts here, but how would guidance documents be failing in a situation where an industry is changing really, really quickly?
So all policy documents are, and all kind of policy vehicles are going to be challenged in any industry that changes really quickly. I mean, so you just mentioned one, Kate, but all of us have experienced the COVID-19 crisis and the change across time in what we've learned about the science behind that virus. And that's why you're seeing, you know, the kind of fits and starts of guidance documents being issued by places like the FDA or the CDC, you know, coming out and sort of backtracking and coming out with a new guidance document. They're trying to catch up with the latest state of the science. And we need all of our government policy agencies to be making their decisions based on the state of the art science. When it's changing, you can expect that guidance documents are going to have to change alongside them.
Well, certainly many Americans who've never paid attention to guidance documents paid close attention to what the CDC was coming out with on their guidance in COVID. Do you think this marks a new beginning on guidance documents and how we pay attention to them?
Well, they've certainly never been in the news more than right now. All right, so if you think back to February and the CDC's announcement of K-12 school reopenings, they had a guidance document about kind of what was the state of the art thinking on how schools would reopen. It was enormously controversial. And obviously, you know, to every parent out there, including myself, enormously impactful as well. Again, it was guidance, but we were hearing from, you know, state and local officials, teachers, principals, union members, parents, that their schools were taking that guidance documents as the implementable policy changes. They had felt like they had to meet those guidance in many cases, even though they were just guidance. So that's a great example of, you know, some of the impact the guidance has. I'll give you one more example that's really controversial. The Biden administration just last week issued a new guidance document on Title IX protections for transgender students through the Department of Education. And that new guidance document is extending kind of greater privileges and protections to transgender students. And that comes at a time when we have at least 31 state legislatures across the United States issuing their own laws or going through the political process, at least, to potentially issue laws around similar issues, especially gender identity and sports, female sports in particular. So it's a great example of the Department of Education weighing in with a guidance document at the federal level on a terrifically contentious political issue.
And didn't the Obama administration do that as well with bathrooms for transgender students? I think it was in 2016, maybe.
Absolutely. It's actually, this is there's a through line between President Obama's guidance document on transgender students, which, you know, many of us heard a lot about. It had, you know, it had implications for bathroom use in schools. President Trump rescinded that guidance document through his administrative decision making. And now we see Biden back with a new guidance document. And, you know, that kind of progression of, you know, different political parties or kind of political approaches to different policy issues going back and forth through the guidance document process is an example of where this policy tool falls down a little bit. Because it's so easy, so flexible, there's no process attached to issuing guidance documents, they can be easily initiated and easily revoked by a new administration as well. And that leads to a lot of confusion amongst the public as well as businesses. I should mention, there are some really contentious issues like the masking mandate issued through guidance. But for the most part, it's businesses that are affected by guidance in the United States.
Well, we're going to look at solutions here in a moment with Susan Webb-Yockey, who leads the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, as she explains the challenges and constraints of guidance documents. Do you write these guidance documents, or is your industry dependent on clear guidance from the government and regulating something? Do you think more guidance would help with government transparency? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Susan Webb-Yockey on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the role and the reach of federal guidance documents and how to improve the system of describing an agency's interpretation of a policy. President Biden signed an executive order in January directing federal agencies to look inward at their policies, at their regulations, their guidance documents to see who's being left out and how they could better advance equity in agency policies and programs. What puzzles you about guidance documents? Do you follow them closely in your line of work? 800-642-1234 to join in. Susan Webb Yaki directs the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, and she stays with us. Susan, let's look at some of the solutions that you have come up with. And one recommendation you make is a government-wide repository to keep track of guidance documents. How would this work?
Yeah, so this is, I think, the most kind of common sense solution that I can put forward on the guidance process. And that's that we ought to be able to have a spot where all citizens and all businesses can look to find out what is what are the agency guidance documents from the different federal agencies? What are the ones that are current and in being currently used by agencies? And what are some of the ones from the past, so we can kind of track that past behavior too. Believe it or not, there's nothing like that. Right now, agency guidances are announced in kind of a haphazard way, sometimes in press releases, sometimes in letters to businesses and constituencies, sometimes in kind of more official policy pronouncements, but really hard to discern what is that. What are these agency guidance documents, especially if you're a regular citizen? You know, so a lot of businesses have full-time staffs, you know, lawyers and others that are tracking really carefully these guidance documents. You or I don't have that.
Yeah, guidance documents aren't like making headlines out there.
Not typically, right? And so what I'm proposing in these new set of reforms is something like a website repository that has some simple information on the government agencies themselves, as well as what are the guidance that they're currently using in making their decision-making. Something that's searchable, something that we can turn to understand the agency's current thinking.
Something I'm curious about, I noticed in the FDA guidance documents, they say at the top of the page, guidance for industry. And I'm just wondering, is that pretty uniform among the federal agencies that they define their audience up top?
It's not. Because guidance documents are issued in such different formats,
yeah.
Right? So again, some are press releases, some are, you know, more kind of directed to industry. There is no kind of common way that's done.
They don't have like a template out there that they're just kind of filling in the information into these holes.
There's no template. And actually, Kate, that's a great point, because when we have templates for decision-making, it actually helps the audience understand the different components of a policy. We can read them much more quickly because we sort of understand where the agency is putting what information. And so that is part of this repository, the idea that there would be some kind of standardization of how the policy documents, these guidance documents look. That again is going to help the reader more quickly discern what the key points are.
I'm still kind of hung up on how to reach the most people and how to do that effectively, especially when it's guidance that might not only impact your job, but maybe your life. And certainly we have seen that over mask wearing the pandemic. But how would like a guidance notification system work?
Yeah, so that's another reform that's suggested. So not only should we have this kind of one spot where it's a repository, kind of like a dumping ground for all current guidance, which is absolutely necessary, but we also need to have a way to signal new guidance, or let's also say rescinded guidance. So when an agency is going to take back their current thinking and are planning to modify it, we need to know that too, right? Mm. So we need to not be out there, you know, acting on good faith on what we think is an agency's current thinking when they have in fact rescinded it, or if they brought it back, maybe because science has changed, or maybe because there's some other issue that we're not aware of. And so in the report, I suggest let's take use of some new technologies to try to get, you know, guidance information out there to folks. You know, let's use Twitter, let's use Facebook, some of the other means by which we can broadcast to large groups of people at the same time, either new policy decisions or rescinded policy decisions. Here's where we can take advantage of the fact where we can sign up on places like Twitter for different lists or different types of policy areas that we might be concerned of, where we can get information from government in a timely way.
We're talking with Susan Webb-Yaki, who directs the La Follette School of Public Affairs, and she's a professor of public affairs and political science. She wrote a report recently on guidance for guidance documents. You can call in with your questions on guidance documents, 800-642-1234. Susan, let's look at the public engagement in guidance making. What role do public comments have? When do they come?
For most agencies, public comments don't play a role in the guidance process. There is an exception. So the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is the main exception. In the late 1990s, Congress was looking at how the FDA was making decisions, and they were realizing really quickly that major policy changes were going through the guidance process and not through the more traditional way in which agencies make regulatory decisions, and that's through the notice and comment rulemaking process. And I'll note that that notice and comment process has a public commenting piece to it, right? And so Congress was really concerned about that. And they were wanting to make sure that industries, regulated entities, citizens, they had a chance to participate in the FDA's policy decision-making. And so think about the FDA. It regulates cosmetics, animal food, your food, medical devices. It regulates drugs, pharmaceuticals, over-the-counter prescription drugs. I mean, a huge swath of things that you and I care about.
Lots of tentacles, yes.
Yep. So Congress was wanting to make sure that there was a public process for commenting during guidance development, and it required it in this 1997 legislation. But for the rest of the federal agencies, there's no such requirement. And so my report suggests that there ought to be, at least for the most important guidance, some means for the public to participate and provide their input on guidance documents.
Are you optimistic that change could happen? Are you seeing any signs out there that there could be change?
I am optimistic. You know, I'm optimistic by the fact that, you know, during the Trump administration, this was an issue that was really forwarded as important. I'm optimistic by looking at the new executive order issued by the Biden administration, which calls out the need to look hard at the guidance document process. I'm also optimistic by the fact that, I mean, this is in the news right now. We recognize maybe not the vehicle, which is guidance documents, but we recognize the importance and the policy topics that guidance is touching. So I am optimistic that there could be some common sense bipartisan reforms in this area.
Susan, thank you for joining us.
I was so thrilled to be here. Thank you very much.
Susan Webb-Yaki is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, professor of public affairs and political science. We have a link, by the way, to her report. It's called Guidance on Regulatory Guidance. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, an author discusses their new book exploring the language of cults, and not only religious cults. We're talking about brands, corporate culture that use similar strategies to gain cult-like following. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.